All right, good evening, everybody. Feels cooler in here than it does outside. It could be cooler, but it still feels better than it does out there. Bob, it's good to see you back. Cody's back from being sick. Other people, I'm sure. It's good to see everybody back. Before we get going tonight, Mark is going to lead us in a word of prayer.
Let us all pray. Holy Father in heaven, we thank you, Father, once again for the time you've enabled us to be here. We thank you for the blessings you provide for us that enable these things. We ask, Father, as we enter into this study, we see more of your word revealed to us, find ways to apply it to our lives, that we need better, be better servants in your kingdom. We ask, Father, you watch over us all and forgive us for our many sins. In Jesus' name.
All right, so if you have your Bibles, you can turn over to Numbers, the 17th chapter. That's where we're at tonight. Somebody tell me, or tell us, what happened, kind of summarization-wise, from chapter 16? What happened with the people and with Moses in Numbers, the 16th chapter?
Well, they revolted against Moses and... swallowed up.
How'd it turn out for the people who rebelled against Moses?
Not so well.
And really, there were several different groups in that rebellion, wasn't there? Who was kind of the main one behind it all? Korah. Does anybody know what Korah's name means? I actually found this out last week and I forgot to say it. His name means baldness, of all things. Old Baldy got swallowed up by the ground. But Korah, Dathan, and this Abinadab, it didn't end so well for them, did it? Their whole families, their tents, their possessions were all swallowed up in the ground. And why did that happen? What was that? How was that significant that they were swallowed up there? What was God saying through that?
Well, it said if something like that happened, then they know that that was from God.
Yes. Moses said, if the earth opens up in an unnatural way, these men die in an unnatural way, we will know that this is from God and not from man, right? No man could cause that to happen. We established that that was an unordinary death, the swallowing up. But was this the end of death in the camp for those couple of days?
No.
What else happened?
Well, there was another group that...
There was 250 men that were with Korah, right? What happened to them? Like Moses said, go on back to your houses, go tend to your children, read them a bedtime story. What happened?
Well, we're incinerated.
It said the Lord descended upon the tabernacle. His presence was there, and fire came out. They were burned up. They were killed. But did it even stop there with death in the camp? In fact, it says 14,000 and around 700 people were killed later on that day. And Aaron went out and stopped that plague. And we showed how Aaron was an intercessor for those people at the time. That he put himself in harm's way by trying to help the rest of the community. And who did we say that was a resemblance of later on?
Jesus.
Jesus Christ. How so? And comparing with Aaron, going to this middle of this plague and separating the dead from the living.
He interceded for us for the plague and sin.
Right.
So that we would not die to sin, but could live with him in heaven.
That group of people was still guilty of sin, weren't they? They had sinned. They were guilty of the punishment that was coming to them. Are we guilty of sin?
Yeah.
Do we deserve the punishment of that sin brings? Yes. But our intercessor, Christ Jesus, put that upon himself to stop that from happening if we are willing to submit to him. So that's really number 16. We said that at how God has no room for rebellion among his people and that he emphasizes that throughout Scripture many times. But in number 17, it's only about 12 or 13 verses. Let's read that together real quick and see what we can take away tonight from that chapter. Number 17, verse 1 says, And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and get from them a rod, each from the father, each father's house, all their leaders according to their father's houses, 12 rods. Write each man's name on his rod, and you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi. For there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. And you shall place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel, which they make against you." So Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and each of their leaders gave him a rod apiece, for each leader according to their father's houses, 12 rods. And the rod of Aaron was among their rods. And Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted, and put forth buds, and produced blossoms, and yielded ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel. And they looked, and each man took his rod. And the Lord said to Moses, "Bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony, to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die." Thus Moses did, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. So the children of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, "Surely we die, we perish, we all perish. Whoever even comes near the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Shall we all utterly die?" Now, who's writing Numbers here?
Moses.
Moses is. Chapter 16 and 17 are really a parallel when it comes to ideas. Chapter 16, was Moses' leadership not challenged? There was a great rebellion that came about. Korah leads these men. He tries to intimidate him. Well, we realize that God chose Moses, did he not? And he showed that through a miraculous way with the earth opening up, right? And it was a boundary where no one else was harmed except those rebels. The 250 people were burned up in the fire. No one else. Those that were people who were with him, followers, that 14,700, they perished too. Okay? So that is clearly set in chapter 16. Chapter 17, we have a very similar idea. But are the complaints against Moses here? Who are they actually against? Aaron. So the people have challenged both of their leaderships. And we see that Moses is addressing this in back-to-back chapters. I don't know how long the time period goes on between chapters 16 and 17. Because between chapters 17 to chapter 20-ish, there's 38 years that go on in between there somewhere. So I don't know if it was weeks, days, months, or even years. But the point of the story is the people were complaining. And God was saying, "I have chosen these men, and I'm going to show you in a miraculous way that I have chosen them." So what's the plan here? What has God put into existence for this to be proven that Aaron was the leader? What's he going to do here?
Give a sign.
Okay.
He's
going to give a sign. He collects their rods, right? And did you notice who he collected them from here? Were these just average Joes, the average shepherds of the camps? Who are they?
Leaders of each tribe.
Okay, the leaders. Do you think these men's names had come up from the companies and from the communities? They're saying, "Well, why not the head of our tribe? Why can't he be our high priest? He would do a better job at this. He might communicate better. He's a holy man." Do you think they put those names up and said that a time or two? I think so, because they were leaders of thousands of people. Remember a couple weeks ago we looked at those tribes, and they ranged anywhere from 20,000 to 50 or 60,000 people. These men were leaders. So who not to pick from the top, right? Dan.
I was going to say, too, even if it hadn't arisen already, this would subdue any thoughts of any future or, you know,
yeah.
If anybody had this in mind of putting their leader of their tribe up, this would...
Well, you're exactly right, because God's going to say, "Let's put this in the Ark of the Covenant to remind the rebels of this." It's a museum piece. Been to a museum, they put something up there? Why do they choose a relic or an artifact to be put in a museum?
To remind people.
To remind people of it.
Yeah.
The Ark of the Covenant is literally a piece of a museum, if you think about it. It's an exhibit where it has these things in there. Is it a holy thing? Absolutely. But these items that are in here for remembrance. Let's think about them. What else is going to be in the Ark of the Covenant besides Aaron's rod?
Some of the manna.
The Ten Commandments, all right? Why might the Ten Commandments be in there? There are no doubt God's laws, but what happened? Was that the original set of Ten Commandments? No. What happened there?
First set was destroyed.
Why were they destroyed?
The people rebelled.
Okay, because the people rebelled against God. They made a golden calf. All right, there's one right there. So maybe they're put in there too for remembrance of things. No doubt it's a holy thing, but to be remembered, hey, you rebelled the first time we tried to do this. Aaron's staff, you rebelled against him. You complained against him. And what's the last thing that's in there?
Manna.
What'd they do about the manna?
Complained about food, buddy.
They complained about the manna too. All these things were reminders that God provided law and order for you. A holy law, he provided food for you, and he provided adequate leadership for you. There were pieces for remembrance of those things, to be remembered among those peoples. But let's think about this. I think it's very, very good here. What did they do with each rod once they got it? They put their names on it, right? Why do you think they put their names on it? I mean, each man would have recognized his own staff, wouldn't he? I mean, you have an item you carry every day. You know what yours looks like compared to what everyone else's. The other day, we were playing golf, and they gave me a cart, and it didn't work. The cart didn't. But the key was a universal key. And as soon as I ever go into anywhere, like my truck or my house, I always empty my pockets. And I empty my pockets into the golf cart. It's not that it would affect my game any if I had it in there. It's that bad. But I always take the stuff out. And I got into another cart and took off, whatever. And we're coming back around. And I'm going to go to the clubhouse to get something to drink at the break between 9 and 10. And I go to find my wallet, and it's not there. Well, somebody had it on the front nine in one of their carts. Fortunately, they turned it back in. But they didn't have it when I talked to them the first time, surprisingly. But when that guy brought my wallet out, did I know that was my wallet? Sure, there was personal things in there that I knew was mine. But even looking at the outside of it, you can tell which wallet's yours, right? Ladies, you can tell which purse is yours because you carry it every day. These men would have known which staff was theirs. Maybe it was because when Aaron's rod was pulled out and had the buds and the almonds on there showing God's approval, could they have argued? Well, that was mine. That's the one I brought up here. You put your name on it, there's no uncarving that is there. It's set in stone. And so God has them do this, has them write their names on it, so there's no argument. You can't argue that. And you even see that later down, I think in verse 8 and 9. Look down there, it says, verse 9, for the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And that's the end of it. You can't argue that fact, can you? So let's think about this rod here. This staff. Well, how do you make a staff? How do you make a rod? Where's it got to come from?
Cut a limb off a tree.
You got to cut a limb off a tree or cut a small tree's trunk, right? When you make that cut through that limb, what happens to the tree?
It dies.
It dies. That's basic biology, I guess. I don't know. Forestry. It dies. So, Joe, can a dead yard produce good fruit or a good lawn if the soil's dead? It can't do that. So God's showing this miraculous thing that this dead branch here grows leaves and grows fruit and almonds, and they're ripe within a day. I wish I could do that with my garden. A day and it's just done. No, anybody who knows, this would take months, right? Weeks to do this. And this is dead. This is God showing his miraculous signs once again. There is no way they could disprove this. Over in Acts, the first chapter, verse 3, it talks about when Jesus appeared before men. He said, with many infallible proofs. I mean, there's no way to say that's not God. That's not the work of God. You have to admit it. And no one looking at this staff with ripe almonds on it in a course of a day's time could say, they couldn't argue that that's not the work of God. And so God shows these people once again who his leaders are. But here's the big takeaway, I think, for this. Were these a stubborn people? They were. Did it take a lot of examples and a lot of learning and extreme circumstances for them to get the picture at times? Look down in verse 12 and 13. Take about 10 seconds to read verses 12 and 13. What's their response here after this happens? Huh? They're lost?
I think they were a little afraid.
There was no doubt fear within these people.
Because they're saying, we see what happened. Or am I going to perish because of the attitude that they had about everything? So.
Yeah, there's definitely fear within these people. Do we see some form of repentance, though?
Yeah.
I think we do. They realize what they did was wrong. And they realize we're not going to come to this, go close to this place, because we're not worthy of going into it. And if we do so, we will die. But let's talk about that fear in just a minute. David.
Well, it also kind of reminds me of that passage that says, let each one examine his own heart. And I think they knew very well that their hearts weren't right. And they knew they stood condemned before God, and they had seen previously what happened to people who were in that condition. And I think, like Bob says, I don't think they were a little afraid. I think they were very afraid.
Was the sole purpose of God putting his wrath on those people just because they were rebels and just to get rid of them? You think that was the sole purpose of what happened in number 16?
No,
it was a message sent as well, wasn't it? He made an example that, guys, this is no playing matter. We go back to Aaron's first two sons. What happened to them with the priesthood when they didn't do it the right way? They were killed. He set an example with these things. And that's the point of the scriptures, to set examples on what to do and what not to do. There's many points, but that's one of them.
So it's a learning opportunity.
Absolutely. That's why we study these things, to learn from them. Dan.
I was going to say, too, it's interesting in the fact that they specify, there's a tabernacle, because this is where the rods were taken overnight, and this is where the transformation happened. So it's even, that's the answer to their rebellion. So, they don't want to go back there again.
Are there things in life that you're afraid of, like things that legitimately make you scared? I think we all do have those things. Losing our children's, I think, my biggest fear in life at right now. But when we think back to when you became a Christian, did you ever feel like, man, that preacher, whoever is teaching, they know exactly what I'm doing. They know what I'm thinking about, what I was talking about. Well, that's the power of the gospel, isn't it? But why did we... In reality, why do we become Christians?
We don't want to go to hell.
We don't want to go to hell. I'm scared of it. Were you scared of it? Hopefully, we're still scared of it to an extent. But our service to God in the beginning was one out of fear, wasn't it? Now, as we grow, what do we serve God from?
Love.
Love and want to please Him. We don't want to disappoint Him. These people, while they may have been journeying with Moses and God for a long time, they were not strong people. They're serving out of fear at this point. Now, are there times where I think God realized that, obviously, but he put these measures into place to get them in check. But we're no different when we become Christians. We don't want to go to hell. We're scared of that. So why do we do it? Well, let's do what God says so we don't go to hell. Hell's scary. And so there's that with that. David.
Well, Psalms 130, and I don't think these people are at this point yet. I mean, this is centuries and centuries later, but David says, if you, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who can stand? But there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared. And there's a lot in those two verses right there. But I think what David is basically saying is that if God wanted to catch us up in a sin and destroy us, he's got ample opportunity. The only problem is there wouldn't be anybody left.
Right.
But we need to recognize that he's a merciful God. He says here in verse 4, there is forgiveness with you But because of that, we should fear God. We shouldn't take that for granted. That should cause us to fear God. I mean, we can fear God just like what you were talking about earlier. None of us wants to go to hell. And that's a motivator. It's a good motivator. But we should also fear God out of love, recognizing that He desires to save us.
There's got
to
be a balance of fear and love, realizing that God's in the ultimate control of our salvation, and that He grants where we go. But we want to serve Him to be with Him forever, but also because we serve Him because we love Him. So any other thoughts on number 17 here before we click out of here and move on? All right, so really the rebellion days are going to start coming to an end here for a little while. Chapter 18 is really the breakdown of the priesthood again. There's some repeat things in there. God's going to talk to Aaron about these things. Their duties, their lifestyles, even the tithes and what their earnings are going to be and what to give along those lines. Chapter 19 is more of the same with laws, but dead bodies, purification, laws, staying clean before God, and all those things. And like I said, we just don't have the time to do that. Go ahead.
I'm trying to find it. I've read so many different types of how confused. But 18 makes it really, really clear that all the tribe of Levi,
right,
except the narrow line of Aaron, they were given to be, I hate to say servants, not slaves, but servants, and to work, but they were forbidden to come near the furnishings and the tabernacle.
Right.
So that follows all those instructions for all that just happened.
Right. And remember, even looking at Korah, they were descendants of Levi, were they not? Yeah, and we talked about last week, they were ungrateful of the task they'd been given. Even though they'd been set apart by God, they were ungrateful and they wanted more with that. And I think that's a continuation of what you were talking about.
It makes it really, really clear, and even what they could eat, what they could eat.
Right.
Some of the men could eat, and then some of the wife and children, the whole household could eat. It was interesting.
Okay. Thank you. Numbers 20 is really kind of the beginning of the end of the journeys in the wilderness. Like I said, 38 years have passed in a matter of about just a handful of chapters, while a year at Sinai took over 40 chapters. So it's the point of tonight really is we're going to see that these people wandered for 38 years, but they made no progress. Can people be in a relationship with God for 38 years, 40 years, but make no spiritual progress? Absolutely. And just be wandering around and realize not even wandering. And we're going to get to that later on. But in chapter 20 here, there's some big points here. And really, verse 1, it's a big instance that happens here, a big event. Chapter 20, verse 1, then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. And that's all we hear about it. She just died there. Now, Miriam's kind of a complex character in some things. What do we know about Miriam? When you think about this, Moses' sister, was she a leader of the people as well? Yes, she was. What do we remember about Miriam? There's three big things that I think about with Miriam. Yeah. So let's go back to the very beginning. When she watches over Moses, did that take bravery and courage? Did it take obedience, listening to her parents? Absolutely. Bravery, because she was a conspirator in this plan to keep her brother alive, wasn't she? And the command was for all the boys to be killed. So she's brave. She honors her parents in this. She stands up for the task at hand. She is obedient. I paint Miriam in a picture of somewhere in her teenage years here. I think she's a young woman at this time. Can people in our teenage years, did we always do what our parents told us to do? No. And even before those teenage years and after those teenage years, it still wasn't always the best. But this young lady here, because she's dealt with the responsibility of babysitting in a sense, she honors her mother and father in this request. So that's a great start when we first get to know Miriam. What else do we hear about Miriam?
She was a prophetess.
She was a prophetess and said she's only like one of nine women, I think, in the Bible we read about. We talked about four of them on Sunday morning in David's class, Philip's daughters. So there's a great thing going for her. What else did she do?
The second thing I remember about her is she
left the Yes. Once they cross the Red Sea, she has this song of praise, and she leads the people in it. So three good things we hear about her. What else do we remember about Miriam, though?
She rebelled with Moses, too.
In Numbers 12, we get this black stain on her record here for a little while. Numbers 12, what happened there?
Challenged Moses.
Yeah. If we read, Aaron and Hur got together and said, God speaks to us, too. Why is Moses the one in charge? Yeah, and I'm not sure if y'all covered that when I was gone or not, but that Moses was the youngest one from what we can read. Why has he got it? Why is he the one who gets all the attention and glory through this? But here's the big picture. We remember those three things, but we also remember that she was rebelled. Do people remember the things we do in this life? Can our reputation be ruined in a matter of minutes? It can. And this happened thousands and thousands of years ago. But we remember Miriam, she rebelled against her own brother, who was a prophet of God. And she was a prophetess. She was supposed to be holy. She was supposed to be set apart from everybody. But that doesn't mean sin can't impact leaders. It impacts everybody. But here's another thing to take away from this. What did God promise back in Numbers 14 when the spies came back with a bad report? What did he say was going to happen? Joshua and Caleb would go in, but if Joshua and Caleb are going in, what's that mean for everybody else? It means you weren't going in. But Miriam, she's this prophetess of God. She's Moses' sister. She's a leader among these people. What's it mean, though? What happened, though? She didn't get to go in. God makes no exceptions for who you are. She had a great physical, social status, didn't she? She was the sibling of the leader of Israel. Her brother was the high priest. She was one of, probably the only prophetess at this time. But she didn't get to go in. God doesn't make exceptions for us. Even though we might have clout on this earth, we may be high up, God doesn't care if we're not spiritually right. And God holds his promises. Miriam could not go in. But here we go again. Verse, I don't even want to read it because I'm tired of reading it so many times. What do the people do? Verses 2 through 4 there. What do they do again? They say it's the same thing every time. You ever realize that? We wish we just would have died earlier. You brought us out here to die with our animals. There's no water. It's hot. And Moses, we're going to see later on, he reacts very poorly to them. He starts off reacting very well, but it gets to him at the end of it. And I don't even want to read it because I'm not lying. I've read this so many times over the last, like, however many months we've been doing this. They complain. They paint this narrative that Erica said last week that's completely false, that they had these pots of meat in Egypt and this great lifestyle. But here we are, Moses. You brought us out here again. And it's like that negative character is on Saturday Night Live for years. That's what I picture the Israelites as. Always negative. But
one thing here, though, this is getting towards the end of going into Canaan, right?
It is.
So in these 40 years, there's a lot of that group that was over 20 that had passed on. So you had the group that was 20 then when God told them to wander. And you've had a lot of them born since that time.
Yeah.
4 years. So what they've done is they've learned some of this murmur from their parents.
People who had no idea what it was like in Egypt.
The ones that was 20.
Right.
Egypt, but there was ones that had been born that would be 40 years old. They had not lived in Egypt.
Correct.
They could only go by memories and what their parents had told them.
Yeah.
Their parents need to be really careful.
The good old days, right? That weren't so good. Yes.
They completely missed the point as well that the reason they didn't get to go into this land of plenty with figs and honey and all that was because of their own sin. They totally missed that whole piece. And I think that you know, if we miss, if we, you know, God gives us consequences to teach us lessons, just like we give our children consequences to teach them lessons and to turn them around and bring them back. And it's like these people completely missed the lesson.
Yeah, you're right. Are there physical punishments for our sin at times? Absolutely. Is there spirit? Most importantly, there are spiritual things. And some of these people, they're going to suffer both of these, I believe, because of their ingratitude for the leadership. And if anything, they should be praying for these leaders. But they're just constantly just nagging and complaining. Remember when Solomon wrote about the woman is like a dripping faucet. It just doesn't stop. That's how Moses feels about this, but like 2 million faucets. Because it doesn't stop. And like he thinks he gets one problem solved, he's got to go to another thing. But here's Moses' response. It starts off really well here. In verse 6, it says, him and Aaron go and they fall on their faces to God. Well, what's that signifying here? What are they doing?
Humbling themselves.
Well, they're humbling themselves, but what are they doing? They're praying more than likely. And they go to God after this nagging and this complaining happens. And God's presence is there. So God gives Moses initiative here. He tells them what to do. And let's read here because this is so, so important. And this is arguably probably the second most important time in Moses' life, I would say. The first being the burning bush at Mount Sinai. And Moses, he starts off so good here, but he's going to get in his own head, and they're going to get in his head for a little bit. Look what God says, though, verse 8. Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, and gather the congregation together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring the water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and the water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring the assembly into the land which I have given them. So, does God give Moses clear directions here? Is it a pretty simple task to do this? What's his direction here? The people are thirsty. They're complaining there's no water for them or their animals. So God gives a remedy for that. He gives a solution. What was his directions to Moses?
Speak to the rock.
So, originally, though, when the first instance of this, what was God's command to Moses when the people were thirsty the first time? To strike the rock, right? Do you think Moses got confused with what directions God had given him this time?
No.
I think he's frustrated. There's several reasons for this. How many times has he hit the rock? He hits it twice. Not only once, but twice. You know, sometime in golf, I'll have a good hole, then you get to the next hole, and it's just garbage. And you top the ball, and it rolls 30 feet. I want to take that club and just demolish it. I don't, but because I have to remember what I paid for them, and I don't want to do that. But you just, when you get frustrated sometimes, you ever just want to ball your fist up and just yell or do whatever, put your head into a pillow and just scream? Moses is so frustrated here. So what's he do? Does he walk up and tap this rock and just... He's trying to break this staff upon this rock. That's the image I get here. Not only once, but he says, I'm going to hit it again. He's going to get his money's worth on it. He let his frustration go. He did things his way. God said, just speak to the rock. And there's symbolism here, Dan.
I want to say also, if you look at what he says, he's taking credit for it.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in just a second. You're good. Thank you for that, though. He strikes this rock right now. He takes his anger out on it. Number one, he has an unbelief in God, does he not? And God says that there. Because he said, I told you to speak to the rock, but you hit it. As if speaking to it would not work. Well, God, you told me to do it. You told me to hit it the first time, so I assumed, just do that again. God said, no, I told you to talk to it. What's the symbolism here? Does anybody know why God's going to punish Moses so much on this? What's that rock represent? Is it just a physical rock here? Remember, it signifies God's word, but also signifies Christ. Christ was the rock. Over in 1 Corinthians 10, 4, it talks about Christ being the rock. How many times did Christ seem to be smitten and struck? One time. So, what does Christ provide for people? The woman at the well, what's he telling them he provides for them?
Living water.
Living water of life. Those who come to me in thirst, I will give them drink. Christ only had to be struck once. This is the foreshadowing of Christ, being that he is greater than all the sacrifices under the old law. That was only needed one time. He didn't have to be struck again. And God's punishing Moses for this because of that, but also are leaders held to a higher standard sometimes? James, what's James 3:1 tell us? Teachers, leaders, they're held to a stricter judgment on things. And God, he did not hallow God as well. David.
Well, you know, we remind ourselves every once in a while about this, but just, I think we need to do it again. Moses was out there with him. I mean, he wasn't riding around like an air-conditioned Cadillac the rest of them. And they, you know, and I don't think it was 91 degrees like it was today, every day, but it was hot a lot. And this has gone on for 40 years, and it's hot, and it's dusty, and there's no privacy. And they're murmuring. And just think what we would do if the elders said, okay, let's all march to J-Town today and make camp, and then break camp and make camp and do that over 4. How would we do? I don't think we would do any better. You know, and he and Moses had the pressure of leadership. Everybody else would complain. There's no food, there's no water.
J-Town is not a land with milk and honey, though. There's a lot of better places around here to go.
I just use that as an example of some place that we could walk to, but we wouldn't want to on a day like today. But you see my point.
Right, I do. They're frustrated. Point number 2, Moses did not follow. What's the language he used, Dan?
Must we strike this rope?
Must we bring you water? Okay, so what's the issue with that?
The attention on himself.
Okay, he puts the intention on himself. But what's he do to God here?
Eliminate.
He doesn't give him the credit, but in fact, he really equals himself out with God with this. He groups him with him. Moses is a sinful man. Now, was Moses a great leader?
Yeah.
Yes. Was he the most humble man that walked the earth at that time? He did many good things for God. He stood up for God with these people. But you can't put yourself on the same playing field with God. And God says, that's not going to fly.
You have to be very careful how you handle the word.
Yeah. Would it be, and he says, you did not hallow me, you did not respect me or honor me in this instance. Because, number one, you put yourself on my level, but you didn't obey me when you had a direct command to do so. Now, did good still come from that rock?
Yes.
Did the people still water? All right, so what's the point we might be able to take away from this? And Paul talks about this sometimes in the New Testament. Over in the book of Philippians, he says that some preach because they want to save souls. Others do it for personal gain. But nevertheless, the gospel is spread. Now, can good things come from people not always doing it God's way or the best intentions? Absolutely. I had written down here that, but what works is not always the best measure of what is right before God. Did it work? Did water come out?
Yes.
But was it the right thing to do?
No.
No, it wasn't.
The only reason the water came out is because God.
Yeah, absolutely. He still took care of his people. But what always seems the best idea in our minds isn't always the great with God. And it might produce results, but that doesn't mean it's the right way to do it. And I think that's an issue today. We have to make sure we're doing it as God said to. But he equivalates himself with God. Over in Psalms 106, verses 32 through 33, it talks about how the people drove Moses to frustration and that he took his anger out in the wrong way. Did he speak as God would have had him to speak? I don't think so. How did he puts himself with God and saying, must we bring water? But how did he address the people in the beginning of it? Rebels. Hear now, you rebels, listen up. That sounds like a drill sergeant, doesn't it? You maggots, get in line. But God didn't, he had this attitude at times, but we didn't see it here with this. He's still providing for his people. Going down, though, and I'll get through chapter 20 tonight. Chapter 20, I would argue, is probably one of the most pivotal chapters, probably the most pivotal besides Numbers 14, when he bans the people from entering the land. That's in Numbers. Because at the beginning of it, Miriam dies, and Moses no longer can lead the people into the land of Canaan. But what happens at the end of chapter 20? Aaron dies. So we really see this is that 38 years that's gone by really quick from what we read. This generation's coming to an end. And this next generation is going to step up. Now this is where we end tonight with this. Aaron, that God tells Moses and Aaron is going to die. You're going to go on this mountain and it's time. His time's up. You're going to pass this on to your son, Eleazar. Now, takeaway for this. Had Eleazar been training under Aaron? Had he seen the things his father had been doing? He just didn't walk in blindly to this role as high priest. Are there leaders in the church today, and are those leaders going to be around forever? No. So what am I getting at here? What's the point I'm trying to make?
And you know, always be preparing ourselves to take that leadership.
We got to prepare the next generation. Prepare the people under, and we got to be preparing ourselves if we are that next generation to do so. God had a plan with this, and it just didn't happen like that. He told him he's going to die. Eleazar was put into place years ago to see these things through, and so it was a smooth transition. Just because someone dies doesn't mean the role dies. The role still has to go on, and it still has to be done. The focus wasn't Aaron; the focus was the high priest. Does that make sense? The focus isn't the messenger, but the message. The focus isn't the man or the elder, but his leadership with that. That role has to go on with it. And also another thing, when it's time to pass that on, you got to be ready to pass that on. There are some men that have understood that completely. There's others that have ran it through to the deathbed, and sometimes we just got to realize we've got to pass that on. It's someone else's time to take in. And take that role on. Let's end with this. Let's end with Aaron. The good, the bad, and the ugly with him. Let's talk about the good with Aaron. What do we remember the good from Aaron being?
He encouraged Moses.
He was a spokesperson for Moses. What else?
He encouraged Moses.
Yeah, he was with Moses side by side and through a lot of this. Definitely an encourager. He was the first high priest. He was God's chosen. First high priest within the order of Israel, within Israel.
He had faith in God.
He did. And he ends up raising his sons in a way to take on that high priest role. If they weren't able to do that job, God wouldn't have given it to him. So I think as a father, he grew throughout time with it. Now, we said Miriam was complex because we remember for some negative things. But I even think Aaron's more complex. Because did Aaron have his shortcomings? He was in the Numbers 12 issue. He was right there with her. And remember, Miriam got struck with leprosy. And when they saw that event, Aaron's like, whoa, we didn't mean what we shouldn't have said that. But also, Aaron's the leader of what happens in Mount Sinai with the calf as well. But I do say this. Those events happened many years ago from where when we lose Aaron in Numbers 20. Just because mistakes are made, that's not the end of it. And we see a lot of growth from Aaron throughout this. Because when we read about Moses after Numbers 12, who's with him every time when he's praying with God to God? Aaron's right there with him. And so we see growth within them. And just because we have some embarrassing, humiliating moments in life doesn't mean it's over. And that we can still do good after that. Thank you all.